Hello and welcome to the Dyslexia Mom Boss Podcast, the show that helps you not only feel empowered and knowledgeable, but confident and a boss mom in the dyslexia journey. I'm your host, Dr. Lauren. Hello, welcome back to the Dyslexia Mom Boss Podcast. I am Dr. Lauren. As you all know, we are in season three, and I am so excited. I know I say I'm excited like every episode, but I mean, season three, it's been a long time coming. I'm loving that I'm finding some really awesome service providers. And today we're going to speak with a neuropsychologist, and I have such a warm spot for neuropsychologists. So I really can't wait to delve into this conversation today with Dr. Jesse Fisher. So, Jesse, would you like to introduce yourself before we hop into the conversation?
Absolutely. Thank you. It's great to get to chat and talk through this. You do some awesome work. So I'm glad to be a part of it here. So, yeah, I am a pediatric neuropsychologist, and the field does not do a great job of advertising, you know, what we do. So a lot of people don't really know, you know, what that is. My parents always thought I was in med school for the first couple of years of grad school. So, you know, it varies what people know about neuropsychology. So I come from this kind of profession, coming from an interest. Actually, it started in sports psychology. And I know you ran track. So I think there's some overlap there. So yes. And I played football in high school and college and loved the mental game and how important that is and how it can kind of push people beyond the limit of what they think is possible physically. Right. And so that really got me into kind of the mental health world. And, you know, obviously with football and concussions got me into, you know, brain injury
brain
interest
part,
there.
Right,
and,
right.
And so my specialization in neuropsychology is in sports concussion and brain injury. But really the bread and butter for neuropsychology is learning challenges, attention challenges, especially for children, and pediatric focused neuropsychology. So that's where we really dive into evaluating, identifying challenges and strengths and weaknesses or areas of growth that are needed and go from there. So it's a little bit about me, kind of in a nutshell.
Yeah, I really appreciate you giving a little bit about yourself, but also a little bit about neuropsychologists because, and I know I said in the beginning, I have like a soft spot. I really do because I feel nothing against educational psychologists or PsyDs or anything of that nature. Actually, are you PhD or PsyD? Because maybe that's something I need clarification on.
Yeah, I'm a PhD. And
okay, that's what I thought.
Plenty
that's
of neuropsychologists have their PsyD. So it's just a different kind of way to getting to the same profession. But
okay.
More of an emphasis there on research on the program that I was involved in. That's kind of typically the distinction there, but it really varies on the program to program that you go through.
Okay, no, and that makes a lot of sense. And the reason I said that, I mean, I'm sure most parents don't really care what exactly your doctorate or doctor degree is in. They just like that, you know, they hear doctor. But for me, I like to understand the differences because I know psychologists can be different from neuropsychologists and educational psychologists and things of that nature. So for me, I just like to understand that. But I have found from my experience being a special educator and working in specialized private schools versus public school, when I have, and I know I actually want to ask you these questions because I think this is really important, but when I've worked with private practice neuropsychologists, the assessments are just vastly different. It's just more in depth. They understand the brain. I find there's more dyslexia on those evaluations. So actually, before I delve into that, let's delve into the questions because really we're here for you. We're here for you, not for me. So I do want to start off with an equity question. So me being a Black practitioner, educator, doctor of education, all of that, and there are Brown and Black people who listen to this podcast, I have found working in places with privilege, you know, being in these specialized private schools, being in just K through 12 prep schools where there's money, there seems to be an equity issue. So why is it that there isn't a lot of access to neuropsychologists in urban schools and communities? And I know that they're there, but it just seems like they're always private practice. Can you explain or touch on this for our audience today?
Absolutely. And I love that you bring this up. This is such a huge issue in the field. I mean, I don't think neuropsychology is necessarily unique in when we think about the field of medicine and education, right? And the inequities there, that for neuropsychology, it's always been an issue. And we look back in the history of just medicine more broadly and how access to healthcare and access to medicine was based on income in a privatized healthcare system, right? We can think of the systemic issues and the barriers there and, you know, the racism in housing. And even though, you know, redlining is not technically legal anymore, those communities are still boxed in many ways to...
Because of the gerrymandering too.
Exactly. Exactly. So there are many ways in which access to healthcare and education means income gaps. And because of that, you know, unfortunately, I can think of it in a systems-wide way, and that healthcare and hospitals follow communities that can afford their services. And so we see big hospitals and clinics following communities that have more resources, and that ends up serving populations that are predominantly white. There are real challenges and barriers there that, you know, the field of neuropsychology really is working to shift. So in the American Academy of Clinical Neuropsychology actually has an initiative called the 2050 Initiative. And so that is really focused on aggressively recruiting more neuropsychologists from diverse backgrounds, really changing the pipeline so that we as a field, you know, really reflect the patients that we're seeing, the students that we're seeing, and so do our tools, right? Everything we're using to assess needs to be more tuned into the population that we see, and that includes improving access. So there's a lot to that. I can kind of get on the soapbox about it, but there's a lot to why the barriers are there. And so it ends up being that poor communities, and oftentimes that ends up being, you know, non-white communities are not able to access these, I consider it, you know, healthcare. And so if we had public insurance covering these evaluations, I think that would be a huge, huge deal. And learning challenges, by and large, right? Insurance companies don't reimburse for that, right? They don't reimburse for that evaluation.
Yeah, so, and that's, go ahead. I'm so sorry. I had something to touch on that, but I finished.
There's a lot of, I know I'm throwing a lot out there, but really I think that it comes down to it being a challenge to function outside of an academic medical center relying on insurance when they may not cover it. And ultimately for the types of evaluations that neuropsychologists provide, oftentimes that ends up being, you know, 20 plus hours of work on one evaluation. And that ends up being not necessarily an easy thing to afford for a family.
Yeah. So you definitely threw a lot out there, which is necessary and needed. And as I was really listening to what you were saying and thinking about the neuropsychologists that I have worked with, really in all private schools, it's $3,000-$4,000 for an assessment. And in the last school where I was actually a learning specialist, the school had been around for many years, since the 1700s. So they have a lot of money. And, you know, I'm in Maryland. So obviously, you know, Maryland has been around for a long time. And I know you're in LA. So California is not that old. But anyway, I bring that up because there were deep pockets. And so they had funds. They had a mission fund where it was for certain families that I guess met a certain criteria where if the school could support them in paying for that assessment. One of the neuropsychologists that I really respected, and we worked so well together because I understood her reports. She understood how I would write my learning profiles, and we would just really collaborate. But she would always do free assessments per year. I mean, I don't know if the school was paying her. I think she did it out of the goodness of her heart, like wanting to literally be like, some of these kids, the brown and black kids, really need this and can't afford it. And she was private. So I just think that that's
new.
And I don't know what it's like in LA, but I know I've heard in New York, you can easily get $5,000-$6,000. And that's like average. And that's crazy.
It is absolutely wild to think that that's, you know, what it cost for a family to invest in figuring out the challenges their student, their child has. Now, I will say, you know, so you touched on that school possibly covering an evaluation. It may vary by state, but I know in California, you request, if you have a concern about your child, I think you've talked about this on your podcast. If you have a concern about your child, you can request to the district that they assess, and then the school will do their assessment. And if you disagree and you have a concern that something wasn't adequately, you know, assessed or evaluated, you can request an independent evaluation.
Exactly.
And from there, the district can cover that private assessment, but it's considered an independent evaluation. And that is something that I also think is really important. And that's some of the work that I do is through, basically, it's, you know, taxpayer funded and public kind of an evaluation where the district is covering that for families. And that's huge because that access issue that we're talking about.
As we're talking about this, it really dawned on me, you know, let's say families can't afford that $5,000 assessment. Mm-hmm. Well, it's an investment, as you said, but here's the kicker. And it's really not funny. It's just the evaluation. That's just the start of the journey.
Yeah.
So it's like, hold on a second here. I've got to find thousands of dollars to get a report that states that my child has these learning disabilities or differences. And now I need to fight the school. Then I have to equip myself. I mean, it's steps and steps and steps, which is exactly why I always say this podcast exists. But I do want to touch on this because this is a hot button topic, at least from my seat that I would sit in as a special educator in specialized private schools and in public school. There seems to be controversy around putting reading disability or SLD or dyslexia, whatever, on a report. Now, I have found the controversy is really putting dyslexia. So I've read many reports where it says SLD, and then I'm reading and I'm looking at the scores and I'm like, I think this kid just has dyslexia. Why didn't the person just put whatever the code is? Like, why isn't it just dyslexia? Or I'll see reading disability or whatever it is. So I want to ask you, number one, personally, in your professional opinion, are you comfortable writing dyslexia on a psych report? And in your opinion, why don't clinicians put that on the report?
Right. It's a great, great point and kind of topic that is still very, I feel like, you know, certain researchers and academics and especially advocates feel very, you know, for good reason, you know,
strongly,
very passionate about.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think the term dyslexia is very important to help communicate to parents, to communities where a student's challenges are. And so I do use it in reports. What I will do most often is use both terms in that as psychologists, we use the DSM, right? That's our kind of label dictionary there. And so we use, you know, specific learning disorder in reading, and we're kind of tied to that language. No label is perfect, but, you know, we use that and then we specify, you know, with impairment in, where exactly is that challenge coming from? Mm-hmm. You know, is it the fluency or is it some other issue? And then, you know, next to it in parentheses, dyslexia, right?
Yeah.
I think it's important to communicate to whoever is reading that report, to families, to mental health care practitioners, to the school in so many ways that, you know, what this is. And so I think it's important to use both when you can. Maybe some schools are not able to by education law. I'm less of an expert in education law,
but
I do know that California, it's okay to use it, but I do see it less often in school reports. So,
according to the Department of Education in this country, there's no legal reason that you can't use it. I think it's really done by district, state, city, county. In Maryland, we do counties. So I think it boils down to curriculum. It boils down to how much is invested with the stakeholders. How much are they willing to actually open up their mind to the science of reading and changing everything? I mean, I think it has nothing to do with actually putting that word there. I think the word is actually more symbolic than anything. If I read a report and I see that a psychologist or neuropsychologist puts dyslexia, I know that they get it. And that's just me being in the seat that I'm sitting in with the 12 years of seeing how kids are just not getting just that validation of like, I have dyslexia. That's what's wrong. And there's nothing wrong, but you know what I mean.
Right. You know, that's a huge part of the dyslexia advocacy that is, right. You know, you're a part of it also just all around this country, that parents and students can kind of feel like they have a community. They have, they're not alone in this weirdly named specific learning disability, right? They have this dyslexia that is close to 1 in 5 or whatever the statistic might be, other students. And so I think it's important for that reason to help them and to communicate that. But because it is somewhat of an umbrella term where there can be many ways that we need to intervene and help a student with dyslexia, depending on the type of challenge they have, that always in the reports, you know, you've got to kind of dial down and drill down a little bit more specifically and say where the challenge is exactly and how do we need to help this kiddo out.
Right. So let's shift the conversation to SEL. So that social emotional learning component. From my experience, I was reflecting on this the other day. I was like, wow, I've actually spent more of my career in middle school than I did in elementary school, which is funny because I never thought I would go higher than fourth grade. And so I taught eighth grade for 3 years and I loved it. And I saw there was so much. Well, first of all, let's talk about teenagers in general. There's a lot that goes on in the teenage mind and body, right? Yeah. Developmentally, they want to be autonomous. They don't want to listen to their parents or their teachers. They think they know everything, but really that's the time where they need us the most, but their hormones are raging as well. Right. So let's just take a child who was never diagnosed and really the root cause is dyslexia. This is just a hypothetical, right? Yeah. But let's just say they really struggle with depression. They've been failing for years. And they get to eighth grade and their eighth grade teachers are like, this kid's lazy. This kid barely comes to school. This kid's asleep. And then all of a sudden it's like, well, we've tried all interventions. We've tried tier 2. We've tried tier 3. Let's try to maybe bring in some special education testing. And we find out, all right, well, this kid needs to be tested. So my question to you is this. Sometimes we have to get one disability under control first before addressing a deeper issue, right? So as I said, the teachers might be like, I think this kid has anxiety, or I think this kid has depression, but really the root cause is dyslexia. So as a clinician, how do you, and this is really more for parents to understand this, how do you sift through that SEL part of the diagnosis? And I don't know what batteries of tests you use, but how do you sift through that in writing the report too? Because I know writing that report is communication. For someone like myself, I need to be able to say, oh, okay, I see that the primary disability is depression, but really the root is this. Like, can you touch on that? Because that's a big thing, especially with middle schoolers. And I've seen it with parents frustrated. Like, I don't think this is the problem, but we've got to get this depression under control first.
Yeah, absolutely. This is so huge for so many students and families that come in, you know, that I see. And the pandemic has only ratcheted that temperature up, you know, and so it's such a challenge. What I'll say is that ultimately you got to it there in that the underlying causes are what we need to target. And so the key part of identification is identifying, okay, what are the underlying factors? What is causing the depression, which may be the most impairing in the moment that the kid can't get out of bed. They don't want to go to school. They're avoiding all work, whatever it might be. But I think that we need to be able to identify that underlying cause, name that in the report, highlight that, and then prioritize the recommendations accordingly. So if we've got that challenge that we know is a root cause, we want to be able to walk and chew gum there with what the plan is going to be. And it may be a lot for a family, but I think this is part of why it's important to kind of walk them through this process of, okay, we need to get supports, maybe beefed up in the school setting.
Exactly.
But we also need to get psychotherapy support. We also need, you know, if medication is needed, you know, have a consultation. I'm a psychologist, so I don't go medication first, but some people really benefit from that.
So
what are the top three? You know, I like to go for it's school supports. We need to bolster those. Let's find out what's prioritized there. If it's home supports and emotional needs, let's get hooked up with a therapist ASAP. But also get started with a specialist who can build those skills back. If it's dyslexia, work on those phonological skills or work on accommodating those challenges to the degree that we can. And if we can get, you know, the top three targeted and include the underlying cause in that, that we oftentimes see that depression lift. And the treatment, the psychotherapy, is not going to be effective unless we're really getting at that underlying issue, like you're talking right. about, and supporting them. I think of it as we've got to stop the bleeding at school and make them feel exactly. safe yeah. and that they can not be on high alert because they're so stressed out in a school setting. Right. We've got to start there. And then the therapy can really help once that's in place.
Yeah, I appreciate your answer. And I think, you know, I don't know if most of the moms that are listening to my podcast are primary age, like their kids are primary age, or if they're in middle school or high school. And I think it's important to really put out there, because I'm just a really direct person, you know, this doesn't go away. The dyslexia doesn't go away. It's how the brain is wired. And so I've talked to many adults with dyslexia. And I said this so many times in interviews that I've done, where I use the term difference in disability interchangeably, because those who were diagnosed and got the right intervention and had, let's just say what you're talking about, the therapy, the support, all of that at first, second grade, they viewed it as a difference because they were able to build their confidence to get the strength that they needed to be like, I am whole. I am great. I have, you know, all of these strengths. But then the ones that were diagnosed at 30 were diagnosed at 25, they were depressed and they just had poor images of who they were in society and would just lower their standards. And, you know, I'm not smart enough to go to college. And there's nothing wrong with vocational school or any other path. But if you are not getting your needs met because of these concerns, and especially once those middle school years hit, those are some tough years to parent. Yeah. And that's really where you have to be keeping your eyes and ears open to what is going on. So I just know, you know, working with middle schoolers for so long, and I have two daughters, one's in college and one is five. And my older one, she had her mental health struggles and it was hard. And we had to really figure, you know, like you said, what's the root cause and what do we need to attack and who do we need to call and all that good stuff. So I just think your answer, it makes a lot of sense. And I really hope that resonates with a lot of parents out there. Jesse, we are actually coming to the end of our episode, but I want to give you an opportunity to share a little bit about your business and, you know, really kind of share. I know you're probably only certified in California, but can you share a little bit about your services? And if anybody in California is listening, maybe they might call you.
I'm happy to do that. So yeah, primarily right now I'm conducting neuropsychological evaluations, children up to young adulthood, and a parent consultation along with that. I love just working with families and figuring out where a child's strengths are, where their challenges are, and coming up with a plan. Really tailor that to, you know, if we were able to do a really extensive evaluation, we can get the nuances of what exactly that student needs to thrive.
Right.
That social emotional piece is so huge that you talked about. And so many kids are struggling with it right now. And so right now, that's the bulk of my work. Some of them are through school districts and public, but also private evaluations. I work through a few clinics in Los Angeles right now. So I think the best way to reach out to me is my website is jfisherphd.com, and my email as well is jesse@jfisherphd.com. And maybe you can link that.
It'll be in the show notes.
Oh, great. So yeah, I think, you know, that's the easiest way to reach out. And I'm happy to chat with anyone with concerns that they need some extra support in some way. And yeah, definitely only licensed in California. Right. I know you've got listeners all over, right?
I do, all over the world, even in Australia. It's awesome. I love it. Well, actually, for those of you who do want some access to Jesse, I do have my parent community that I know you're a part of. And I'm really excited about it because I want it to be accessible for all parents. And I always tell people you can be as involved or as not involved as you want to be, because I send out monthly content that I feel like is necessary. We'll have monthly group calls, and all who are subscribers are welcome to come and I'll facilitate conversations or answer any questions or talk about resources. And then there's always a monthly newsletter. So this is new. And this episode is actually premiering in January. So the community will be about 2.5 months old. But December 1st is right around the corner. And that's when everything really kicks off. So I would love to see more faces around the world to have some connections with us so we can really help support you in this journey. Because I think, Jesse, you and I are really big on the SEL and it's really, really paramount. So I want to say thank you so much for your expertise, your time. I'm so excited about season 3 and service providers. This is just amazing.
Yeah, that's great. This is a blast. And really, you know, the work that you do is amazing to flatten, level the playing field, you know, and that information that you get out on your podcast and other ways is so important for families. So keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you so much. And I really appreciate you coming on the show and we'll talk soon.
Okay, great. Talk soon. Bye.